I'm the one that hears the siren and hangs on to see what's going on. Found power in sex. Discovered girls and found it was even better. It's a power source. It gives me the sense of accomplishment, ease, comfort. Stress is gone. It does what I'm looking for. It gives me the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a couple of drinks. But early on, there's other sources. I found power in money. There's great power in money, if you know how to do it. I got a problem. There's only one reason to have money. Spend it. There's very little power in spending it. You got to manipulate it. I found power in being sick. When I was 6 years old, I had scarlet fever. Temperatures that actually put me in comas off and on for several days. I still have a clear memory of waking up several times and having heard my folks talking. There was another guy in our house. He happened to be there when the doctor diagnosed me and quarantined the house, so he couldn't leave. They had to burn everything I touched. I was being cared for and looked after like you couldn't believe. When I was there, I was really getting taken care of. But the whole idea that they had to burn my plates and stuff I touched, and this man couldn't leave because I was sick, I found power in being sick. So along over the years, periodically, I did sick pretty well when things got tough. There's power in it. Did you ever do that? Yeah. Because I'm a word mechanic, one day, just for the hell of it, I broke the word into its two component parts, powerless, and had one of those fun little games that your head will play with you. I have less power than I need. Bingo, the lights went on. If I have less power than I'm going to need to accomplish any task, I might as well have none at all. So I suggest to people, don't be afraid to let your mind go play a little bit. As long as you have the foundation solid, it'll fit every possible thing you can bring to it if it's the truth. Okay. I'm still a power seeker. This is all about seeking power. There's no other reason for this. It tells us in this book, its main object is to help you find a power greater than yourself that'll solve your problem. This is about power seeking. I don't pretend for a minute it's not. If you don't find the power, you're dead. Because I can't keep you sober. And this group can't keep you sober. And AA can't keep you sober. If it could, we wouldn't have so many people drink after coming here. Reading the big book won't keep me sober. I know people who drink and read the big book. I know people who read the big book and drink. By itself, nothing. Okay. So I'm a power seeker, and I have found the power today that I needed to find. I suggest to you on page 45, where it says its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. It does not say problems. It does not have an S on the end of it. I only have one problem. It causes me a lot of problems. There's some guides here for not only working the program, but for the future. And because I have a mind that will not quit, it won't shut down, ever. I can put it to sleep and it'll still dream. It works all the time. There are very precious moments when I can get it quiet, but boy, they they're hard to come by. I can think one thought at a time now as a result of cleaning out all the things I was angry with and afraid of and guilty about. When those things aren't in my mind, it settles down pretty good. But it is suggested, it says, do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. So through the process, if you're working with me and I just offer it to you, ask yourself, well, what does that mean to me? What does that mean to me? I throw the word God around here and I don't have any idea what I'm talking about. I can't give you a description. The better my relationship and the more my sense of God's presence has become, the less I can describe to you. But what does that mean to me? What does powerless mean to you? You get to ask yourself that. It's a wonderful tool along the way to engage that idiot that lives in there and has something to do. Now this is going to sound schizophrenic, but I love the little monster. There is within my mind a piece of something, call it ego or whatever you will, that has never forgotten anything. It's like a computer. It has access to every little thing that's ever happened that caught my attention, and some things are just on the periphery. Unlike a computer, it does not collate those things well, nor put them together correctly. It just stores information and presents it at odd times. Usually in some garbled fashion. Depends who's operating the stick, right? When I get frazzled, I mean, this thing's got to have something to do, so I let it do all that kind of information storage and sorting and retrieval and all that. It's a busy little thing in there. And I'm reached the age where every now and then I don't remember things, particularly names. The function that produces the labels for people and other things has been damaged, and I don't always get it. And I found out that I can make a request. We need this information. Would you go get it and bring it back? Sounds goofy, but it works. Then I can get on about my business because I trust the little monster. You go get it and bring it back. A name or a location or whatever I need. I just have to be patient and wait for it. If I push him, I get the finger. It's like a deep pool, and beneath the surface of the water is every piece of information I will ever need about anything. And all I have to do is put the request in and it'll float out. That's another way it occurs sometimes. But I have to have a quiet mind to do that. If there's a brainstorm going on and the waves are high, it doesn't work. Just some images that along the way have helped me. Serenity is not that floating like a zephyr on the soft summer air. I've done that. Good hash will do that. A quart of Southern Comfort will take you there. Okay. So I used another book. I used the big 3-volume Webster's Dictionary just to kind of locate things. And I found a definition of serenity in there that works for me. Clarity of thought. Clarity of thought is serenity. That's what it produces. When I'm thinking clearly, there's peace in my mind. I'm serene. It's almost like floating like a zephyr on the soft summer air. What does the term serenity mean to you? What is a power greater than myself? We went over powers greater than myself one day. As I sit here right now, I'm almost brought to tears by what Bruce really did for me. He gave me his time. I don't know how much time I've got or how much time anybody's got. It's pretty precious stuff. And he gave it to me on a regular basis and helped me wade through the muck of my own mind. That's pretty precious stuff. we talked about powers greater than myself, and they were all negative at that time. He'd draw it out of me. Guards, courts, systems. We talked about all kinds of things that were clearly a power greater than I was. Alcohol, all kinds of stuff, and it was all negative. Until I understood that I believed in all kinds of powers greater than myself. It was no great leap for me to say I believe in a power greater than myself. I've got a whole list of them. All we had to do was make a shift that will restore me to sanity. And then the bastard got me again. I had in mind what I'd been doing for 34 years, minutely tracking down moment by moment, year by year, to find out when I went insane. That's it. He said, no, 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 no. We will just assume that you went insane about 2 seconds after birth. Okay. So just forget everything you think you know about anything, particularly about spiritual matters. Well, I rebelled at that. Surely I know some truth. And he said, it's really doubtful. But it is possible. But I'll tell you something. If you know any truth at all, when we're all through, it'll still be the truth. And all the rest of it's garbage anyway. So just throw it all out together. Accept the fact that without God, I am nothing. I know nothing. I laugh hard at old Schultz on Hogan's Heroes because he says, I see nothing, I hear nothing, I say nothing. Yeah. I know nothing. Without God, I am nothing. I am lost. So that's where we come to. We're brought to a place on page 47 where it says simply, all we need to do is ask ourselves one question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? Isn't that a silly question? What an ego I've got that I even have to ask that question. A quick look around says, of course there is. Anybody closer to that switch than I am can turn the lights out. But I have to ask myself that question. I saw in Bruce and I saw in Phil and I saw in Roy something I wanted. Changed men who were able to not just function, but actually be alive in the presence of death. They lived in cells, but they were free. They were not contained. They had something I wanted. They told me it was God. I had no idea what that was about, but I was willing. And in my eagerness, instead of pursuing the path that was laid out, I went my old way. I went running back to my cell after I made a decision, I want this, and said the third step prayer with all the fervor I could muster. I meant every word of it. Had a terrible experience, because nothing happened. I had put demands on how God was going to come to me. I'm going to say the prayer, and then I'm going to wait, and I'll get a flash of light. Cell door will open, they'll send me home. I will then acquire a jacket with patches on the elbows, a place on the side of the hill with French doors where the peasants can come by, and I can generously dispense wisdom for the rest of my life. And nothing happened. Nothing. Terrified me. I've got to get rid of all my fixed ideas. I have no idea how God's going to come. I have no idea for sure if He's going to come. One of my favorite stories I picked up during the doubting, oh not me, I'm different period old farmer out in Nebraska during the drought time. Came out at 6 o'clock in the morning. It was already 102. And in the milk bottle in the kitchen table was a note from his wife. Said, "I can't stand it no more. I'm running off with the milkman." Goes out on the porch, and the poor old dog had crawled under the porch that night to get out of the heat and suffocated, and the dog's body was there. Looked across over here, and his young teenage daughter was running into the barn with the idiot from next door. Goes out and gets on his tractor and heads into this dust bowl he's got to plow. The right rear tire goes poof. The front end falls into a gopher hole. The radiator goes psh. And he looks to the sky and he says, "God, oh God, why me?" And a voice comes booming back out of nowhere saying, "Oh, I don't know, Ralph, there's just something about you pisses me off." Well, that's kind of how I felt. It was made clear to me I did not need to understand God, to know about God. I simply needed to become aware that where I was, God was. The presence of God, that's all I need. Scary place. If the concept of God says he sees everything you do and everything you think. Because I'd been thinking some really weird stuff for a long time. And doing some pretty weird stuff for a long time. And that's pretty scary. I'm faced now with the proposition that either God is everything or God is nothing. God either is or isn't. What's my choice to be? There's a choice I have to make, and it won't matter which one. Isn't that wonderful? If I choose God as everything, there's nothing to worry about. If I choose God as nothing, there's nothing to worry about. But I've got to make a choice. I've got to quit being wishy-washy about this deal. It's all or nothing. I'm faced with made these guys attractive to me. Well, made clear I'm not looking out here anymore. I got to look in here. Very frightening. But the promise that I can face and be rid of this stuff is what brought it around. And let me tell you what I had to face and get rid of. And it's high drama stuff, but every one of us has this kind of high drama. I went to the federal penitentiary in 1966 for a failure to pay $96,000 in taxes on a load of marijuana I brought into the United States. That's what the tax was, and we didn't pay it. Now, that's the surface stuff. I was hired to do a job because I was insane. These guys had gotten this load of marijuana to Juarez, and their courier had been busted for something else. So it was stashed in a hotel, and they were all afraid to go get it. They didn't know who might be watching it, but they knew they wanted to get it. And somebody said, "We'll call Pritz. He'll do it. He's crazy." At this time, I've got two little boys. When my oldest boy was 2 1/2 and his brother was a year old, their mother left. She's also an alcoholic. And we'd been on the road for a while. And they were with me. Now, one of the reasons they thought I was a psychopath is because I demonstrated that I had no conscience. It was clear. They offered me the job and I took it, of course. I didn't take it for money. I took it for the prestige. For self-aggrandizement. It's really prestigious in that particular community to take the kind of risk it took to run in there and get that stuff out of there and get it back to Albuquerque and dispersed. There was big-time ego satisfaction in that. And I took the job, and I'm not an idiot. I made them get it out of the hotel and then take the transfer somewhere else. But I got that across the border because I knew some things about human nature and I had no conscience at that time. I packed the stuff in an air mattress and then resealed it. Then I put dirty diapers on top of that, and then I put my two little boys on top of that. And when we hit the border station, I yelled at them so they'd be crying. Because they don't stop you and give you much shit. When the place smells like dirty diapers and the kids are crying, they just want you moving through. Yeah. And that's, I also had 2 quarts of vodka. But to be able to look at that, the promise that I could get rid of whatever it was that allowed me to do something like that was taken away, and the guilt that goes with it left too. I am incapable of even considering something like that. But I lived with the fact that I did that. Okay? If you've done something to hurt your kids, let me tell you, I know about that. And you can be done with it and get on with life. Okay. To face and be rid of the things that have been blocking us. God didn't hate me for that. If anything I've ever done should have brought down the wrath of God on me, that should have been it. No. When I got even worse than that, I was accepted by fallible human beings. They accepted me as it was where I was. And I came to believe partly because I could see these guys are really imperfect. These weren't Boy Scouts. They weren't even all that cool, spiritually fit. They took me as it was where I was, and I thought one day, you know, if they can do that, as imperfect as they are, maybe this God they're talking about can do that too. Just little steps forward in making that happen. Okay? There's some lovely stuff in here leading toward the third step. But there's a big piece that I want to share with you because it touched my life deeply. And little Kim, first time I met her, she was buttoned down. Young girl, she had on combat clothes and combat boots, you know, the camouflage stuff, hat down to here, buttoned down to here, buttoned up to here. This child had been abused by her grandfather when she was 5. And she was buttoned down. You didn't touch her. You didn't get too close to her. She was alcoholic, so she was coming. And she asked me a serious question. She said, what could I possibly have done at 5 that would make him do that? What do you mean my troubles are of my own making? So Kim and I talked about it. And this is what she gave to me that I'm going to give to you. Because we worked through that. She did nothing at 5. Shame on that old man. What a terrible thing to do. That's real. That happened. Somebody ought to horsewhip him. Okay? The very first time she remembered that, it wasn't what really happened after all. It was already changed. 15 years later, what was keeping her buttoned down was memory after memory after memory after memory of something that never ever happened because she talked to somebody else or added to it or taken away from it. And I remember doing that. That was one of the processes I had. So her troubles, the feelings she had today, the victim and all that, were of her own making. When we let that go, we could look clearly at the fact that that old son of a bitch ought to be horsewhipped. But we're told in here one of the ways we look at this thing is to understand that the people who wronged us are perhaps spiritually sick. I don't want to be owned by the kind of people that do that kind of thing. And if I resent you, you own me. You got to seek him today. Long, flowing black hair. She'll hug you. She'll tell you she loves you. She still thinks, as I do, that that old son of a bitch ought to be horsewhipped. But he's dead now, so, okay. things happened to me in my life. I got beaten with a rubber hose when I was 11 for having sex. I should have been given an ice cream cone. Or a cookie. I carried that for years. Warped me. A number of other things happens too. Warped me. Poor old me. And I hung on to for dear life with what kept it hooked in place was, how could an 11-year-old possibly have known it was so wrong to have that happen? What a bunch of crap. When I got into the inventory process and looked at it with clear eyes, I may not have known why it was wrong, but we were hiding. I knew it was wrong. That's all it takes to get free, just to get honest with the fact that, yeah, I knew it was wrong. There's no victim in that. Those are some of the things that we're going to face in here. Our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. Do you really believe that? I do. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it'll kill us. We could not reduce our self-centered as much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. And then they go on and give us some images. There's some wonderful stuff happens here. I think in images. I'm a word mechanic, but I think in images. There's a piece of me that needs a whole picture. And it's got to be part of what's going on. So I'm giving some images. Let's take a look at these images and see if any of them fit us. Okay, first of all, we're going to quit playing God. Why? Because it didn't work. Not because I want to, not because I think it'd be a better thing to do. It just doesn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God's going to be the director. What does that mean to me? I've been asked to do that. What does that mean? Well, let's think of a stage play. There are a few actors that are good directors, but very few. Most actors are good actors because they have the ability to become character-centered. They become the character. And I know a lot of actors, and I've done a little. And I don't care what character it is, I know it's going to play better center stage. In every case. You ever listen to actors? They don't look at parts. They look at how many lines do I have? How often am I going to be out there where they can see me? They get character-centered, and so they don't see the whole play very well. Need somebody who can stand back and look at the whole business and put it all together so when it is your turn, you really do shine. And sometimes you only have one line, but it's the pivot line of the whole play. A good director is necessary. I'm not a very good director. I've proven that in my life. Bill gives us that wonderful business about the actor. Read my mail with that one. Okay, if God then is the director, okay, that's an image I can accept. Okay. He's not the scorekeeper. He's going to be the director. He's the principal and we're his agents. That was an easy one for me. I've been a salesman most of my life. The principal decides what the goods are, how much they're going to sell, and what territory they're going to sell them in. The agent goes out and does the job. Okay. I can kind of go along with that. Can you go along with that? I'm not going to decide anymore what the goods are. When I decide what the goods are, I get in trouble. I bring the wrong goods into the country and don't pay the right taxes on them. You know, even after they sent me to prison, they still wanted that $96,000 in taxes. Yeah. The federal guy came to me and asked for that, and I said, wait a minute. He says, I'm doing my time. Do I still have to pay the taxes? He says, what do you think this is all about? And they did that to five of us. $96,000 each. I pay my taxes today. I'm not messing with them guys again. He's the Father and we are His children. And at the time I first encountered that, I was really pissed at my dad. And through good sponsorship, I was taken to why. We just read it in the earlier session. Deep down in each human being is the fundamental idea of God. I know what Father is supposed to be, and my dad didn't match up. And it made me angry with him. Nobody's dad could. Okay. It means available 24 hours a day, all the time, full protection, no mistakes. My God, what I put on my dad. Shame on me. Because he didn't match up, but because I knew what it was. I can live with that image. It's an easy one for me to deal with. If he's the Father and we're his children, that makes us all kin. And the relationships are clear. Okay. I've got a chance of getting along with you a little bit better if we're kin. It's just an image that today I can work with. Maybe you can't. It doesn't matter. He gives us several of them here, huh? Now he describes another spiritual awakening. Shall we see if we've had it? We're being asked in a few minutes to turn our will and our lives over and surrender to, consciously and deliberately, to a power greater than ourselves. And I want to have a little experience first and did have. Let's see if we've had this experience. When we sincerely took such a position, remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Okay. There's one I can work with. What do I have to do with my life? Well, each morning I have to show up and say, okay, here I am. You're the boss. What do you want me to do? That's all I have to do. And he'll provide everything I need. And I watched him provide for Bruce, and through Bruce, he'd provide for the group. And for me and for all of us, I can get a... Have you had that happen? Do you have a sense that there's a new employer and he's going to provide everything we need? Look at this. We got us a room. We got plenty of chairs. They're not that comfortable, but we got plenty of them. Provided food. Provided us all an opportunity this weekend. Do you know we made a 12-step call this weekend? If we don't do anything else right, we did that. I know of at least two people that have been with us this weekend that are really, really fresh. And we did what we were supposed to do. Gave them the message. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves. Does that happen to you? Scary, isn't it? Was for me. For somebody who's totally self-centered, to somebody be interested in somebody else is a little frightening. My God, if I don't take care of me 24 hours a day, who's going to? Now, you may be interesting, but I'm far more interesting. We became less and less interested in ourselves and our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. I remember the pain of really believing that nobody would let me help them, that nobody would let me love them. It didn't matter that I wasn't loved. I hurt because nobody would let me love them, it seemed. That nobody would let me help them, it seemed. But I had nothing to contribute, that I was useless. That's a terrible time. And I began to see, even early on, how I can make a contribution to life. If I don't do anything but show up, I have made a contribution to life. I've made the room less empty by just showing up. I know people watch us. I know people watch me. Before they make a decision to step fully onto this path, they watch me for a while and see if I really do what I said I'd do in the meetings. You know how I know that? I did that. I watched Bruce, and I watched Phil, and I watched those AA guys before I made a decision. I'm not following anybody anywhere ever again.
progress. I'm sure that they're going in the right direction. As we felt new power flow in, have you felt any power recently that you didn't know about before?
Scary.
Yeah, tell me about that. It's scary. Aren't we funny? We are power seekers who are terrified when we get the power. Because now we got to do something with it. Oh, we're funny. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, and that's taken on a new meaning for me. I used to think that means I will finally have some. I finally realized it means just what it says. I don't know how to enjoy peace of mind. I don't like it. When it gets quiet, there's something inside my head that says, well, now we better do something here. Stir something up. This is too quiet. There's something wrong here. Blah, 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 blah. Do you do that, Norma Jean?
Yeah.
I've learned to enjoy peace of mind. Most of my mornings are absolutely gorgeous because I go into a little room I made for myself and I sit in an old chair I've been hauling around for, my God, 25 years. I've recovered it, now it's got a blanket over it, and I just sit there. And nothing special. I just sit there and enjoy peace of mind. Wondrous thing. Have you done that? Have you had any moment in the last year when you just sat still for a minute and it was okay to just sit still for a minute? If you've done that, that says here, that's a spiritual experience. As we discovered, we could face life successfully. Not that I always do, but I can. As we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear. Today, tomorrow, and the hereafter, we were reborn. Does that describe anything that you had happen to you? Would you be willing to surrender your entire life from here on forward to whatever it is that can make that happen? Because that's what they're going to ask us to do next. It's another jumping off place. We're now at step three. However you conceive God to be, if this happens, I'll give myself up to this. Okay. A sense of purpose, a sense of direction, a sense of power. Just enough. I don't want to run the universe. I don't even want to run my house. I just want to have that sense that if I'm called on, I can come to the line with it. Okay, I'll be there. Well, if we want to do that, this is now step three, and suggests a prayer. Now let me give you a view before we say the prayer. In spiritual terms, amen is a closure to a prayer, to a conversation with God. So be it. This is so. It ends this piece. There is no amen at the end of what we call the third step prayer. The only amen I can come up with is at the end of the seventh step prayer, which is actually the third step prayer with teeth in it. Okay? So my view is that everything from the word God to the amen at the end of what we call the seventh step prayer is all part of the prayer. It's one prayer. Prayer will become activity and action. But this process we're going to get into from here on is a spiritual process, not an intellectual process. God will help me with that. There will be power to do that. I need the power to even look at my life. I don't have the honesty or the power to look at it. I'm going to need some help. And I'm going to ask for it. Listen to what this says. This is a cheap shot, this prayer is. God, I offer myself to thee to do with me and build with me as thou wilt. In street talk, that means from here on, my life is none of my business. Do with it as you wish. That's a big commitment. Okay. I will go where you want me to go and do where you what you want me to do. Just tell me. I gotta tell you something. If you say that, you better mean it, because I have been called on since the time I took this prayer to do things that are way beyond me. Over and over and over. This is one of them. My life is not my business. My conduct of my life is, but my life is none of my business. I really love this woman. And given my druthers, I'd be home every weekend. We'd lock the door and shut off the phones. Okay. But I don't get my druthers. I got to go out and do this stuff. I had to go to Russia one year in November. That's a crappy time to go to Russia. I had a good time. But for 17, I've called her every day we've been married. In fact, every day since I met her. Except for that 17 days. That was a hard 17 days. I'm really glad I got to go. But it's because I said this prayer. I am not the kind of person you would send as an emissary to Russia. That's what you did, you know. You're not too bright. You weren't paying attention. You sent me and four of my compatriots who had no more sense than I do to tell the Russian government about Alcoholics Anonymous in an attempt to make it possible for it to happen over there. You're not too bright. But we all had made this commitment, so we went, and it just went fine. We didn't do anything special except walk through there. Build with me and do with me as thou wilt. It strengthened my character to make that trip. It wasn't because I had character that I made the trip. It strengthened my character to make that trip because I had to do something that I didn't want to do. I had to get me completely out of the way. Because every word we said to the Russians, who ask us questions constantly, we had to be very careful of what we said because they would do exactly and respond exactly to what we said. We were at a public meeting in Moscow. A doctor had written a book about AA, and it was very pro-AA, and they were having a public forum, which is customary there. Hundreds of people, government officials, regular people, big auditorium, critiquing the book, so his second edition would be even better. And we were introduced as the Americans from Alcoholics Anonymous. And when it was my turn at the microphone, one of them asked me that loaded question. How do you think Alcoholics Anonymous will work in this country? That's really a scary question, or could be. I was here. You put the words in my mouth, and I heard myself say, I have no idea. I've only been here for 13 days. It would be presumptuous of me to even comment on how it would work. And I started to clap. I became aware of the danger I'd been in. Any other answer would have shut him down. What a glorious thing it is to be led like that. Then I was able to explain to them, well, I don't know, it has worked quite well in 144 other countries. That's the kind of direction you get if you make this. But if you make this commitment, that's the kind of stuff you're going to have to go do. Do you know where we really get it? Someone will come into my life and say to me, I can't stop drinking. How do you do it? And they want to know right now, what do I have to do now to not take a drink right now? I have to pray about that. Build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Okay. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. That's mean. It doesn't say relieve me of the bondage of self so that I get to feel better. Okay. Only so I get to do your will better. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. your power, your love, and your way of life. Don't take away my difficulties so that I can feel better. I've come to believe that what they mean by take away my difficulties, it has nothing to do with this out here. Take away the difficulty I'm having in being honest, in being thorough, in recognizing you and recognizing my faults, all those difficulties that I have. Take them away, please. So that I can sit in this chair and tell everybody in this room that's exactly what it did for me. It relieved me of the bondage of self. I became free in a penitentiary. I got out of prison when I was locked up one night. And he took away the difficulty I had being honest, and there's a price I've had to pay for that. I can never again have I been able to say, I didn't know that. I didn't know that was wrong. I didn't know the truth. I do. I just am too weak to do it sometimes. But I know what's right and what's wrong. The price to pay for this prayer is that you will know. The truth will set you free, but it'll kick your butt along the way. Okay. But it's worth the price. I had to go, my baby daughter, she's still my baby daughter, did something one time that really pissed me off. I won't go into the whole story. Jackie remembers it. She and Kelly were having a little argument, and I didn't like the way it was going. And I started to get out of my chair to fix it. And something in my head said, sit down, shut up, leave it be. And I got up anyway, and I fixed it, and I created more chaos in our house that day. I've got the inventory right here if anybody wants to see it. It was a beaut. And I knew the whole time I was doing it, I was being stupid. I knew when it was over what I had to do, and I had to go back to this poor child and tell her I was wrong. That I still didn't agree with her, but I was wrong. There's a price to pay. We always talk about the upside of surrender. There's a downside. You want to do that? Is that prayer suit you? It's a mean one. How would you like to do it? I'm convinced that God doesn't care whether we meet him standing, sitting, laying down, kneeling, whatever. I really don't think God gives a damn. Okay? I really enjoy doing group third-step prayers. I must tell you, one time someone had a seizure. But I think she'd have had a seizure anyway. I don't believe it was because of the prayer. So if you're afraid of that, don't worry. It was the same kind of group as this. If you have a seizure, we'll just make sure you don't bite your tongue. I'm making a joke, I know, but it did happen. Would you like to say a third step prayer with me? Because I'm going to say it and get on about my business. Okay. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me, and to deal with me, Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do than Thou will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those Thou would help, and Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Okay. That was pleasant. My experience with God has always been pleasant. I hope you had a pleasant experience too. everything we do until we finish up the seventh step, because of what we just said, is part of this prayer. Everything we do. Events are going to occur in my life from this moment on and for until I get through this little house cleaning process. Every bit of it will be applicable to what we call inventory, to house cleaning. Do you like what just happened to you?
Yeah.
Just that sense of presence. That's all there is here. It's not going to get any better. Okay. No great mountaintop stuff. There will be moments of great elation, but this is what it's about. It's about being still enough for me to hear the voice of God. In my experience, God has never, ever yelled at me. Never. It's a very gentle, quiet voice, and I must be still or I won't hear it. Whether it comes through your mouths or in that special way he has of talking within me, I won't hear it unless I'm quiet. And all the inventory is an effort to clear away the stuff that's making noise in my head. The resentment, the fear, the guilt, the anger, the self-centeredness, the where's mine, it's cleared out. So my mind's quiet. So it says next, we launch on a course of vigorous action. The first step of which is because this will have little permanent effect unless we at once follow it by a strenuous effort to face and get rid of the things that have been blocking us. We're not going to write all that inventory tonight. But I can say from my experience, if you do it the way the big book suggests, and I'm going to show you a couple of things I do, you're already inventory experts, so I won't take much time with it. For most people, there's three formats here. There's a format for resentments. There's a completely different format to examine fear. And there's a completely different format to examine conduct, starting with sexual conduct. But it's good for all conduct. There's approximately, roughly for most people, about 8 to 10 hours of actual work involved in the resentment piece. Okay. Unless you just have to go insane and have 2,500 names, in which case, find another sponsor. I ain't listening to that. Okay. Be thorough, but don't be insane. I had one kid do his fifth step, and after 10 straight hours, he was like you, Bill. He had one of those minds. I was literally dying. It just sucked the juice right out of me. And I said, I'm dying. We got to quit. No. So I climbed up on his bed and went to sleep. I woke up about 2 hours later, and he was still talking. His 10th step, one time I came home and there was a 10-minute 10th step on my answering device. He didn't care who was on the other end. Anyway, I use what I call a checklist method simply because it works. I take it a little at a time because this is a delicate area and my mind is subject to get deliberately confused the issue. My ego really will kick in at this point and do its best to create trouble. So I do a little checklist thing, which simply means as we go through the direction book, and by the way, to my knowledge, this is the only place where there are specific directions on how to do it. We have a lot of good philosophical books written about this, but this is where the directions are for me. Sentence by sentence, it takes me through the process, and it was written this way because Bill knew that somewhere along the way, as much as we depend on each other face to face, there's going to be somebody with just the book. And they need to be able to get the same results. And so you can do this with just the book. We're lucky. We don't have to. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways is what has defeated us, we consider its common manifestations. Are we convinced that self manifested in various ways is what's defeated us? simplifies the deal. I don't have to look for any complex Freudian things. What's wrong with me is self. Resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. Big piece of information there. Did you catch it? Resentment is not a mental or emotional problem. Resentment is a spiritual disease. It must be the granddaddy of all of them, because it says from it stem all forms of spiritual disease. And I got to ask myself, what does that mean to me? Well, it means a couple things. If I resent you, you own me. You can be dead, you can be in another town, it doesn't make any difference. You're in my life. You own me. And I do not want to be owned by the kind of people that piss me off. Okay, ever again, by anybody. The second thing is that resentment separates me. And isn't that what they're trying to tell us is our problem? A sense of separation. If I resent Bill, I am separated from Bill. And if I'm separated from the children of God, I'm going to be separated from God. It's just that clear. If I resent Bill, I miss Bill entirely. Because I don't see him. I see him up here in my head, who I think he is and what I think he's done. And so I miss him. Okay. It's a spiritual disease. It separates us. For we've not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. Whoa. I had to change my whole idea about spiritual. I thought spiritual was automatically cool. You can be sick spiritually. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. I'm a little goofy, but I straighten out mentally and physically. I have some physical problems, but what the hell? I carried this model over some rough roads and rode it hard and hung it up wet many times. I'd be surprised if I didn't have some, but I straightened out mentally and physically. So what do we do? It says here, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. My question, if I'm sponsoring you, is, have we done that yet? Oh, okay. We don't have anything else to do until we've done that. We set them on paper. We haven't done that because we don't know how. Well, maybe if it's really a textbook, it'll tell us how to do it. Let's read on just far enough to see. We set them on paper. Oh, we listed people, institutions, and principles with whom we were angry. Okay, go home. Do that. Then come back when that's done. And I'm going to do that too. And I always have mine done before you because I've been practicing longer. And my list is always shorter. And I'm a smart ass and I'll let you know that. Okay. Then we ask ourselves why we were angry. After we got the list made, why we were angry. In most cases, we found it was our self-esteem, pocketbooks, ambition, or personal relations, including sex, hurt or threatened. I keep it that simple. The only reason I ever get angry with anybody is because you either hurt me or threaten me. Nothing fancy. That's just what it says. The only way you can threaten me is to make it appear like I'm not going to get something I want. Or I'm not going to get to keep something I think I have. There's all kinds of stuff involved in that. If you hurt my self-esteem, you can call me a big dummy. And if my attitude toward you is that you're a big dummy, it doesn't faze me at all. If I need you to like me and you call me a big dummy, you can devastate me. I need to be free of that. If you can hurt or threaten me, I need to be free of that. It's the only reason I resent anybody. It's my defense against my own pain. So we make up a grudge list. This process is wonderful. I can take a brand new person, still smells like booze, and get this much done. Make a list of everybody you're angry at. That's easy. That's all I'm thinking about. Why are you angry at them? That's easy. We put down all the reasons. They give us a format here. We get all that done. Why am I angry and what's being affected in my life by that? It's very simple to do. The most important part of this whole process is what happens between the third and the fourth column of this inventory. Up to this point, I have a grudge list and I have an attitude. If I'm telling the truth, I've already bypassed, but I shouldn't feel this way, and I'm putting down, but I do, and here's why. He did this to me, and she said this about me, and blah, 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 and it's all down there, and it's ugly, and I'm righteously right about it, although I'm beginning to get a hint at this point that there's something wrong. This is so important. I know you've read it. Do you mind if I read it? Because I love to hear it. So we went back through our lives. There's the direction. I start from today with Bill, and I move on back to Uncle Louie as far back as my memory will carry me without. When it stops working, stop writing. Clear some of the crap away, and pretty soon Aunt Millie will show up too. You got plenty of time the rest of your life to write the stuff you missed the first time. My first inventory was a lie anyway. I didn't do it this way. I dashed off and spent 2 hours writing out a catalog of some of the worst things I'd ever done. I went back to my sponsor with it. 2 hours I took. From the time he said, God will reveal himself to you as you reveal yourself to you, I was back 2 hours later with this list of stuff I'd done. He looked at it and he said, that's garbage. You wrote that to impress me. Get away from me. Told me the truth. I took my first fist step with somebody else because I am an alcoholic and I am self-willed. And I spent 2 hours being scrupulously honest. By God, somebody was going to listen. And I awakened spiritually in that lie. Because I'd tell this guy something I'd done and he would say to me, well, that wasn't that bad. And I'd tell him something else and he'd say, well, that wasn't that bad. And I awakened to the fact that there's something wrong here because some of this was that bad. But I had picked somebody who would tell me what I wanted to hear so I wouldn't have to do anything about it. And if I didn't stop that immediately, I was going to die an ugly death. Meaning I'd have to live an ugly life for a while first. And so I went back to it. So we get it done this way. My first real inventory was pretty shabby. I didn't have much memory left. So when I say it was shabby, it was kind of short. But I did it this way. And I got into some things. When we finished it, we considered it carefully. When you got all this done, consider it carefully. And they even tell us how to consider. What a marvelous mercy this is. They even tell me how I can go about it so I don't get confused. The first thing I see is that the world and its people are often quite wrong. On my little boy's birthday in 1966, federal narcotics agents came to my house. They do not come gently. One came through the front door, literally. One came through the back door. One came through the side window. They knocked me to the ground, handcuffed me, stood on my neck, called me several kinds of bad names. My four-year-old let out a shriek, and this big cop swung around and almost shot him. And I went from resentment to hate right there. And I carried that for a long time. That was on this list. Count on it. Right near the top. Okay? And he was wrong. And to this day, I think that's a really shitty way to make a living. Breaking people's houses down, stepping on their necks, and nearly shooting their kids. That's a hell of a way to make a living. And the world's people are often quite wrong. That doesn't make me right. But I can recognize they're often quite wrong. To conclude, to those, it was wrong as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome is that people continued to wrong us. And we stayed sore. It just this moment occurred to me, because I'm a word mechanic, another dimension of the word sore. He's talking about being sore and angry. A sore is a very painful lesion. Okay. Resentment is a very painful lesion on my soul, I expect. Anyway, that just ran through my mind. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore ourselves. It's plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. Remember, self-worth talked about us getting a brand new mind? Here it is. And here's what the new mind thinks like. The old mind thinks that son of a bitch broke into my house and nearly shot my son. I hate him. Shame on him. The new mind says it's plain that a life that includes this kind of thinking, this kind of deep resentment, can lead only to futility and unhappiness. Well, that's pretty clear. It was to me. I was in my second penitentiary, and he was still loose on the street. I wasn't getting too far with this kind of a deal, this kind of hate. To the precise extent we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? And I love the word squander. Deliberate waste. You can accidentally waste something, but squandering it means you know its value and you trash it anyway. And I can't duck the fact that I know that to be true. I'm wasting my life and yours, and I know it, and I can't do anything about it. But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We find it's fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again, and with us to drink is to die. The new mind has to understand if we're to live, we have to be free of anger. That just doesn't seem fair, does it? It really doesn't seem fair. Everybody else gets to be angry. If I'm going to live, I got to be free of it. It doesn't mean I won't get angry. It means I better get free of it pretty damn quick. I cannot nurse anger. It's too strong a power. It'll shut me off from the power I need. Do you like righteous anger? I do. Well, not too long ago, I had a piece of that, and I just deliberately stayed pissed for 3 days before I wrote inventory because it felt so good. I just wanted to get every little piece out of it that I could. I had to stay away from nice people. Because I had to look like I wasn't angry, but I just let it steam. It was so good, and I really was right. And then, see, I had to let it go. The grouch and the brainstorm are not for us. I love the grouch and the brainstorm. After what he did, I should have, then he would have, then I could have. And then I'd have told him, and he'd have done. Pretty soon I got it going. Give me another drink. This is good. It's not for us. If we're to live, we have to be free of the anger. The grouch and brainstorm are the dubious luxury of normal men. For alcoholics, they're poison. I just need to know that in my mind. I know when I get angry, I know today I must be rid of this. I will take actions. Do you ever have an emotional hangover? She's a normal person. I've seen her get angry and 10 minutes later be perfectly all right. I get angry, fool with it for a while, and for the next day and a half, I am tired. It just wore me out. And I'm thinking, how much damage did I do? Do I have to clean this up? What was wrong with me? Oh, blah, 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 blah. And I make myself tired. Isn't that dumb? We turn back to the list. This is the list we've just made. We're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. My book, by the way, says we're prepared to look for it. It was a printer's error along the way. We spent numerous hours debating what it was for or at until I just went to New York, went to the archives, got the first edition, and it's at it. We're prepared to look at this list from a different angle. Okay. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. If I resent you, you own me. Okay. This man I hated from the bottom of my heart owned me. He dominated my thinking. He dominated my actions. He dominated the way I treated people. He ruled my life. The wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. And like an idiot, I should have known by now, but I didn't, I went to Bruce and asked him, how will I know whether it's fancied or real? He said, if you are involved in it, it's fancied. And Kim put words on what that meant for me. The minute I recall what that cop did to me and my kids, it was not what that cop did at all. It's my emotional flap going on over about what that cop did. It's fancied. It's colored by all the times I got. You know, I even came up with a plan to get it. Wonderful alcoholic plan. I found out where he lived. I began to stalk him. Jesus, how stupid can you get? He's got a gun and knows how to use it and has already demonstrated he's quite willing. But I'm stalking him in my head, and I know where he lives. And I had a plan. I was one of Owsley's runners out of Berkeley in the 60s. We had some liquid acid that would put you away for weeks. And I know about acid. It was discovered because it got on a scientist's hand and went right straight into the bloodstream. You don't even have to swallow it. You just have to get it on you. And death was too good for this guy. I mean, I was insane. I was going to get 5 00 caps of liquid acid and tape them to my hand, find him and shake his hand and forgive him and send him to the moon. It didn't occur to me that we're going to get a little on me, too. No, stupid. I don't have any problem at all considering how dangerous resentment is to me. I actually did that. I didn't find him, but I was on the way to finding him. Resentment is a killer for me. Bad news. Fancied or real, it has the power to actually kill. So if I'm involved in it in my head, it's already fancied. Just don't even worry about it. How can we escape? We saw these resentments must be mastered, but how? We couldn't wish them away any more than alcohol. This is our course. We realized the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. That they, like, though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Whole new way of thinking. What does that mean to me? What does spiritually sick mean to me? It means I'm separated from God. I'm separated from my power source. And when I feel separated, I behave badly. So all that means is if I can take a look at you as perhaps being separated from your source, no wonder you're behaving the way you are. You're scared as I am. You feel disenfranchised like I do. No wonder you're behaving that way. And I don't get the luxury of saying that, sick son of a bitch. I got to say, perhaps, like myself, this person is behaving this way because they don't have any choice either. It's a whole new way of thinking. Spiritual leaders for centuries have tried to teach us, if you have anything against your brother, if you're angry with your brother, you've got to get it cleaned up first, because you can't get in the temple carrying it with you. And the temple's within. Same deal. Forgiveness. I must give forth without reservation. Okay. To clean it up. They, like myself, are perhaps spiritually sick. A whole way of looking at it. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. At that time, I did not grant sick people patience, tolerance, and pity. They scared me. I had to have a script for everything in life, so you'd like me. I did it so I could do it right. And there's only one script for visiting with sick people. Is there something I can do for you? And that scared me. I was afraid you might have something for me to do. Empty my bedpan. Stay here for a while with me and read out loud to me. My God, I got things to do and people to see. Just sit here quietly with me for a while. I didn't know how to do that. I could not grant you patience and tolerance and pity. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. I do not never have, when I resent somebody, prayed that they get everything I want. How utterly silly that is. I don't even pray that I get everything I want. I certainly don't pray that they get everything they want. I don't pray for justice for them either. My only prayer for you, and I will pray for anyone, is that God's will be done in your life too. My prayer is God save me from being angry.